Rolling.
This is the FedSoc Films Podcast,
where we continue the conversation
sparked on film.
You want to know what freedom tastes like? It tastes like this beer.
Take one.
This is, in fact, the classic solution in search of a problem.
Action.
That cannot help but be controversial.
Cut.
With expert discussion and analysis.
With the greatest legal minds on the topic today. The FedSoc Films Podcast.
It's a wrap.
Welcome to the FedSoc Films Podcast. I'm Samantha Schroeder, Deputy Director of FedSoc Films. Today's episode is inspired by our film, Image of an American, Frederick Douglass and the Right to Vote, a documentary short that explores Frederick Douglass's journey to ensure African Americans have the right to vote through the creation of the 15th Amendment. Here to provide us with a hot take on the constitutionalism of Frederick Douglass is Professor Bradley Ribeiro, Associate Professor of Law at BYU Law School. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, why is Frederick Douglass an important figure in constitutional thought?
Well, I think he's an especially important figure because he's dealing with a key issue at a pivotal moment in our country's history, right? So, at the time in which he, well, first let's get on the table, right? Douglass is, he's a former slave, right? So he escaped from slavery to freedom, and at the time he did this, constitutional fervor in the nation was at its apex, right? Everything at that time, let's say between the 1840s to, I don't know, about the 1860s or so, became a constitutional question. Whatever you were wondering about, it was always a matter of constitutional concern, and nothing perhaps more so than the issue of slavery, right? So here we have a former slave, right, turned abolitionist, turned sort of social reformer, and he's sort of trying to find his grounding in how he's going to proceed in advocating for abolitionism. All these things are happening at this immense time of constitutional inquiry, right? And so just for that reason alone, I think it's important to understand where Douglass sat on these questions of constitutional interpretation, what the Constitution meant, not only with regards to slavery, but perhaps even other constitutional concerns, and what that would mean for the nation, both in the antebellum period, but also moving forward.
Where did Frederick Douglass present his take on the Constitution?
Well, he presented it in several places. And this is something that I note in my scholarship and perhaps what some tend to gloss over is that Douglass's constitutionalism actually sort of evolves over time. And so it wasn't just in one spot at one given moment in time, but I think the best place, if you just want to know, okay, what does he think about the Constitution? How does he make his arguments that, let's say, the Constitution is an anti-slavery document? Look at his Glasgow speech in Scotland in 1860. I think that's where he provides perhaps his most concise, but also most comprehensive treatment of the subject.
So what brought him to Scotland in 1860?
Well, that's an interesting story, actually. So Douglass, after he escaped, I'm going to take it back just a little bit, just so
sure.
Give us some context.
Yeah.
But so after he escapes from freedom, he publishes My Bondage, My Freedom. It's a narrative of his life as a slave. After he publishes this, it piques the interest of slave captures. And then several of Douglass's friends tell him, you need to escape. So he escapes to England. And it's while he's in England that he starts to reform some of his ideas and the like. But nevertheless, he was in England because on the United States, he wasn't seen as a free man. He was just seen as property, right? Even in the northern states, he was property just waiting to be snatched up by slave catchers. So he had to escape. But now when he returns, right, he starts to continue his anti-slavery efforts and advocacy. And, you know, he doesn't make a whole lot of friends. But a few friends he does make, and one of them is John Brown. So John Brown was a pretty prominent abolitionist and social reformer at the time, but he had, let's say, more radical views with how to address the problem of slavery at the time. And he came to Douglass with an idea to arm the slaves themselves so that they can form an insurrection, they can then escape to the mountains and eventually make their own bid for freedom. And Douglass at the beginning, I'd say, or at least by his own account, he was sympathetic to this because he fought for his own freedom, right? So I think in his mind, he thought, well, why not? Why shouldn't the slaves fight for their own freedom? But as he got to meet with John Brown Moore and learned the details of this plan, he realized that it just wasn't prudent. It wasn't going to work, and it wouldn't even possibly be a good idea for the slaves, merely because John Brown, his plan was to actually take over a federal armory and then arm slaves. And so, wow. So break not only, let's say, Southern laws, but then also federal laws as well. In this bid for freedom, and Douglas decided to not hitch his wagon, and rightfully so, because the raid was completely botched. It went terribly. I think most if not every one of those involved in the raid, both slaves and those who were trying to help them in their bid for freedom, were captured and either hung or sentenced to prison in one way or another.
Wow.
But either way, a long story short, this is what caused Douglas actually to move back to England in the early 1960s, or let's say the late 1950s into the early 1960s.
1850s?
Caused him to move to England from the late 1850s to early 1860s. He, you know, was implicated in this, let's say, foolhardy exposition right to free slaves.
So what was Frederick Douglass's non-criminal take on freeing the slaves and his approach to the Constitution?
Yeah, so his approach was first it operates off of a theory. He had a theory, much like other northern abolitionists, that the Constitution and the nation at the time, between let's say 1840 moving forward, was grasply in the hands of the slave power. It was this sort of conspiracy understanding that the South actually controlled the federal government. The North's interests were always put aside in favor of Southern interests. And so what Douglas recommended is, well, we need to take back power. And it's directly through voting. It's directly through moving your feet politically, as it were, to effect change. But we can't do that unless we look at the Constitution as a means by which we can adequately address the slave issue. Because there was dispute at the time, even amongst abolitionists, whether, let's say, the Constitution could actually be used as an instrument to eradicate slavery. Mm-hmm. Many Northern abolitionists simply thought, well, we should continue to use what's called like moral suasion, right? We should mm-hmm. try to convince people of the moral claims, mm-hmm. right, with regards to slavery and why it should be stopped. But when it comes to the Constitution and federal government, they have no power. Mm-hmm. But Douglas wasn't having that. Mm-hmm. He believed that the federal government did have power, and we needed to vote people in office that believed that as well, so that they could use the very same federal powers that the Southern states had used to, let's say, capture the North. Well, he thought, why can't we capture the South as well?
Absolutely. So how drastically did Douglas depart from his contemporaries here?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a interesting study on this, Sources of Anti-Slavery Constitutionalism, a book by William Wiesek, where he puts, let's say, people like Douglas in what he calls like the radical camp. And in that sense, he's probably right, right? So Douglas is somewhat on a fringe, right, of even the fringe, right? So abolitionists in the North at this time, let's just say, in some respects, they're sort of on the fringe of society. And mm-hmm. and Douglas and his camp is somewhat even more so on the fringe of that, right? Because you have, let's say, more like your Lincolnian type abolitionists or anti-slavery advocates saying, we don't want slavery to extend to the territories, but we can't touch in the states. While Douglas is saying, no, we can actually eradicate slavery in all of the states. And so in that sense, yeah, he was a somewhat of a radical departure from others.
So what was the dominant interpretive method of the Constitution at the time that Douglas was interpreting the Constitution himself?
I think it's somewhat of a combination between text and history, I'd say. Mm. Not unlike the way originalists interpret the Constitution now. Mm-hmm. Almost everyone, when they try to understand what the Constitution required, they always looked at the text and try to do what's sort of called a plain reading. Mm-hmm. But then also they try to buttress their, let's say, their plain reading with evidence from history, right? And that was really the fight at the time. Mm-hmm. What was the historical understanding of the Constitution? Did it protect slavery in the ways that, let's say, Southern advocates would like to argue that the Constitution did? Or did it have more of a standoffish approach? Mm-hmm. Maybe something not unlike, say, like Abraham Lincoln suggested, mm-hmm. This idea that, like, well, slavery was set on sort of the course for ultimate eradication, but as far as immediate abolition, it said nothing? Or was it more like Douglass's camp, where no, the Constitution implies immediate abolition? Mm-hmm. These were sort of the different ways to understand, but all of these things, all of these various modes of interpretation always went back to the history. And nothing was more contentious, perhaps, than after 1840, when James Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention are published. Mm-hmm. And then it makes everyone even more interested in the history and what actually went on in the convention to understand, well, what does the Constitution mean for us now?
Interesting. So what would people today say about Douglass's constitutionalism? Originalist, textualist, neither?
So if you're asking me, I think it depends on who you ask, frankly. Right. I think that's the right answer. If you're asking me, he's an originalist. But he's not an originalist in the way, let's say, the predominant strain of originalism that we see today, which is sort of this original public meaning originalism. Douglass fits somewhat into that category, but he definitely has revisions. He fits in that category because, much like originalists today, what he was concerned with is not what he called the sort of secret or supposed intentions of the framers, mm-hmm. but what the public understood the Constitution to mean. So when he would provide evidence, and you can look at this in the Glasgow speech, mm-hmm. When he provides evidence supporting his interpretation of the Constitution, he doesn't say, well, this is what James Madison said about the Constitution, or this is what Alexander Hamilton said. Mm-hmm. He's always pointing to the public. Mm. He's saying, well, this is what the Methodists understood the Constitution to mean, or this is how they would have understood it at that time. So in that similar way, he's looking at the history of public meaning, just like originalists do today. But like I said, he has a spin on it because he believed firmly in natural rights principles and believed that even this inquiry into original public meaning, the history of the text, you have to have a natural rights framework as you do so. And I think it's this move that would cause some originalists to say, well, okay, I can accept that he's an originalist, but he's one that maybe I wouldn't agree with, mm-hmm. while others would just frankly say, that's not originalism.
So who was the audience for his Glasgow speech? Did his speech influence anyone's thoughts on interpreting the Constitution?
His audience of the Glasgow speech was, I mean, obviously people in Scotland and he's actually responding to, I forget the name now, but there was another delegate from the U.S. who had very shortly before Douglass had made the argument that the Constitution was a pro-slavery compact. Mm-hmm. And in this sense, he actually was sort of mirroring the Garrisonian position. Mm-hmm. So William Lloyd Garrison, he's a prominent abolitionist. At the time. And he's actually sort of, you could say, the abolitionist who sort of reared Douglass in the abolitionist movement. Mm-hmm. But then there was a breaking between the two on this question of constitutional interpretation. But Douglass is actually sort of responding to him. So in a sense, you can also understand from the Glasgow speech, not only is he giving you sort of his novel understanding of how to interpret the Constitution, but he's directly responding to a very mm-hmm. popular notion at the time that the Constitution was a pro-slavery compact. And as far as whether it heavily influenced others at the time, I don't know that I could say with certainty that that speech influenced a lot of others. But what I can say is people listened to Frederick Douglass at this point in time in his history and the years immediately proceeding afterwards. You start to see more and more congressmen, senators, people of public note, Abraham Lincoln himself. They're writing Frederick Douglass to understand Frederick Douglass's position on certain social, political affairs. So in that sense, I think we might be able to reasonably infer mm-hmm. at the very least people were listening to what he had to say.
Absolutely. That's a big deal. Mm-hmm. Those are some heavy hitters.
Yeah.
So there was a rather stark contrast or stark separation between William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass in the 1850s. What was the nature of that conflict? What caused it?
Yeah. So when Douglass, started in the abolitionist movement, he started with the Garrisonians. And the Garrisonians had a very much a moral suasion tactic, right? They would go around in these conventions and convince people of the of the moral damnation, right, that was heaped upon the nation because of slavery, right, how evil it was, and that's why it needed to be eradicated. But when it came to political considerations, the Garrisonians were firmly anti-political. They believed that if you participated in a system that was complicit with slavery, you were also getting your hands dirty, and then you were complicit with the with the system itself. Mm-hmm. And so Douglas, just like William Lloyd Garrison, in a very early stage, was saying how the Constitution was a covenant with death and an agreement with hell. But after Douglas fled to England and he had some separation, let's say, from the Garrisonians, he did much like he did while he was a slave, which led to his ultimate freedom. He thought for himself. And this freedom of thought led him to reconsider his position on the Constitution. And eventually he arrived at the conclusion that no, the Constitution is actually an anti-slavery document. It's not a pro-slavery document. William Lloyd Garrison says something to the effect of, there's roguery here, because he believed that that Douglas, being convinced of this alternative position, was influenced by money or other nefarious reasons. And he seemed to discredit the possibility that Douglas himself could have actually arrived at this conclusion on his own. But nevertheless, this caused a rift between the two, and at least in the 1850s, caused significant tension at anti-slavery meetings, associations, and conventions because there was this noticeable rift in a very small community.
Huh, interesting. So Douglas joined this abolitionist movement at a time, like you said, rife with conflict over the Constitution's meaning. How do you think, if at all, that affected his approach to abolition?
So if we go back to this idea of this rift and remembering that the Garrisonians were sort of anti-political, Douglas, his revised view of the Constitution made him very political. So in that sense, Douglas changes, at least I argue that he changes from, you know, he was a former slave and then he becomes sort of a social reformer or activist. But now he sort of becomes a statesman, or he starts to become a statesman when he has this renewed vision of the Constitution, because he realizes what the nation actually requires isn't sort of an upending of the entire system or disunion, as the Garrisonians would suggest. They're like, well, if we're going to do anything political, let's just dissolve the union, dissolve the laws, right? Because they're no good. What Douglas said, no, the laws are fine. What we need people in power that understand the true meaning of the laws and will implement them properly. And so this affected his sort of abolitionist tactics, because now when he's convincing people, he's not convincing them to stay away from politics, but to get into politics,
right?
To be involved, to be active as political and constitutional actors to try to affect change.
Right. Get free and then get to the voting booth.
Yeah, exactly.
So did Douglass's contemporaries, especially white Americans, take his views seriously?
So his constitutional views or just his views generally?
Right, yeah. Did they take his, you know, constitutional interpretation seriously, being that, you know, he didn't go to law school and he's a free slave to statesman?
I would say that they took them seriously, in as much as you find, let's say, other anti-slavery advocates responding to his types of arguments, if that makes sense. So what I found in private letters, at least with like Salmon Chase and some others who were sort of prominent constitutionalists of the time, they're absolutely going back and forth on some questions of constitutional concern with Douglas. But more often than not, what you see is sort of a public response to, let's say, the Douglas type position, right? And this is sort of your Lincoln approach. I think he's maybe the most prominent figure right at this time, where he's trying to assure Southerners, no, we are not, we cannot, right, affect slavery in the original states. It stays there. What we are saying is that slavery cannot be extended, right, beyond the original states. New territories, as well as the North, slavery has to remain, it has to remain free, right? And so in that sense, I guess you could say maybe in a way, right? They're sort of responding to Douglas, even if it might not be direct.
Is Douglas the first former slave constitutional theorist?
Is he the first? I think it might be possible that he's the first
At the very least, the most prominent former slave constitutional theorist.
Yeah, I'd say he's the most prominent, right? Because you have plenty of former slaves who write very moving accounts of their own time in slavery, much like Douglass did. And amidst sort of bringing those accounts forth, right, to the, let's say, the northern public, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know how much the South is reading these things. I doubt they are.
Yeah.
Right? But in as much as sort of a northern audience is reading these things, mm-hmm. they're keeping these things in mind with regards to the Constitution. Because remember, at the very beginning, we talked about this idea that everything sort of became a constitutional question, right? Mm-hmm. So in that sense, as far as former slaves who had something to say about the Constitution, I think implicitly all of them talking about sort of their bid for freedom and mm-hmm. what that meant and what it meant to be sort of a at least incorporated member of society, even if they weren't fully incorporated. Mm-hmm. These all had constitutional implications. And I can only imagine that people at the time when they're reading these things, they had to think about, yeah, what does it mean for our nation? But I think it might be fair to say that Douglass was at least the most prominent constitutional theorist that was a former slave.
Great, fascinating. How did Douglass's ideas on constitutional interpretation affect our understanding today?
Yeah, so I think that's a really good question. And in fact, there's been a lot of movement recently, I think, that makes understanding Douglass all the more important. I don't know if you've, so originalism is sort of what most people understand, the sort of conservative legal movement to sort of represent, right? Mm-hmm. But there's been this interesting new strand of sort of common good constitutionalism, but then also common good originalism. Common good constitutionalism comes out of like Adrian Vermeule and some other sort of Catholic integralists. But then there's others such as Josh Hammer, who he's at least argued that what we really need is a common good originalism. So our originalism is somewhat similar to how originalists understand the Constitution, but we always understand the Constitution according to its ends, its original ends, right? Mm-hmm. And that's how we interpret these things. And I like to think that Douglass sort of has almost this middle ground between at least originalism as we understand it now and sort of this new branch of common good originalism. I think it's sort of a middle ground between those two because Douglass says, well, no, we absolutely need to understand sort of the evidence, the public evidence, as it were, out of history and what certain provisions meant. But the way we select which meaning matters to us now is based on natural rights principles. So I'll give you an example of this. You'll find this in the Glasgow speech. Frederick Douglass argues that the Fugitive Slave Clause isn't really the Fugitive Slave Clause at all. It did not contemplate fugitive slaves at all. Now, my sense, I mean, I could be wrong about this, but my sense is originalists would balk at that immediately. They'd say, no. You look at the context, right? The history, when you look at persons held to service and that language, right, in Article 4, this seems to suggest that it's talking about slaves. Even if it doesn't mention the word slaves, we have enough public historical evidence to suggest that it does. Mm-hmm. And Douglass says, okay, I'll give you that. There is evidence, right, that this involves slaves, but there's also evidence that it involves indentured servants. Mm-hmm. And because it also involves indentured servants, that's the original meaning that we ought to latch on to and not the original meaning that discusses fugitive slaves. Right. And so it's this interesting move. Right. And he does this based on natural rights principles. He says, well, natural right is completely against this idea of slavery. And other people at the time who believed in natural rights, they also understood this. They just thought, well, yes, it's against. So technically, these laws aren't just, but we have no power. Right. Again, we have no power over the slave state, so we can't affect those things. But Douglass says, no, we do have power. And in fact, when you're interpreting the Constitution, you always keep natural rights in mind. And so we're gonna limit the meaning, right, of the quote unquote fugitive slave clause to only include indentured servitude. And so in this sense, I think it matters for us today because I think it just gives us perhaps another way that we can use original meaning, right, in history and how sort of that bears on us today in our contemporary constitutional interpretation or how we understand the Constitution. But again, this is that very same move that I think mm-hmm. will cause some to say, well, Douglas really isn't an originalist at all because he made this move, while mm-hmm. others would say, okay, he is an originalist because he's still within, let's say, the scope of historical meaning, mm-hmm. even if he distorts that meaning in a way that originalists might not agree with.
What got you interested in this topic?
Yeah, that's a good question. In some respects, I have COVID to thank mm-hmm. for that. But when I was entering the PhD program, I got my PhD at University of Notre Dame. I'm wrapping up a PhD at Notre Dame. And when I initially came into the program, I had this thought of, well, I find originalism appealing, but at the same time, I think to myself, well, how do we bring sort of natural law principles to bear on originalism? And there have been several answers to those, and some that I find rather persuasive. Lee Strang has a pretty good book on that, but I guess I would say I wasn't ultimately convinced. But I kept going back to Frederick Douglass just because he has such an interesting take, right, of these things. And I noticed that he has these sort of originalist elements, but it's not quite originalism. So what is he doing here? And it, I guess it's that inquiry that really led me to study him more. And the more I've studied him, just the more he's convinced me.
Awesome. Great. Well, thank you, Professor Ribeiro, for joining me today for another episode of the FedSoc Films podcast.
Well, thanks for having me.
Our guest today was Professor Bradley Ribeiro, Associate Professor of Law at BYU Law School. You can check out the film Image of an American, Frederick Douglass and the Right to Vote on YouTube, Facebook, or at fedsoc.org. That's FEDSOC.org. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe for more episodes of the FedSoc Films podcast. If you like this episode, please leave us a review. As always, the Federalist Society doesn't take any positions on the issues discussed. That's a wrap.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.